So then continuing with the king, finish with the king, is the, so now in the king, so now we've been discussing what the king is doing. He's gone in the morning, he has discussed, he has taken his bath, he's risen early, he's taken his bath, then he's dressed himself properly in that, then he's performed yajnas, he's respected Brahmins, and after he's done all this, then he enters the court. And after seeing all the people in the court, then he finishes, then he will discuss with his ministers. And then in the ministers, we've discussed so many things, what he will do. And one of the things that he will do is here is in protecting the kingdom if there's need be for war. So then the details of that then are being given here. And so, yeah. So here it's mentioning war. He can go off. It is specifically mentioning the winter months are very good, because in the winter people are very strong. You don't become affected by the hot weather. So these are very good times for fighting. But if not, then you can always go a little later, whenever the army is ready. But the idea is that it should be some time before the rainy season. So it gives that the Chaitra, that means the month after Gaur Purnima. So like April is about the latest, because then May, June, and then July will start your serious rains. And then when the rains come, it's very difficult to do any of these things. Because here we see everything's working in its natural way. So people are still dependent upon nature. There we see all through here, very much the whole kingdom is running depending on understanding human nature. That you're going to have heads of all the different positions to run the heads of the villages, then above them, who's in charge of more villages, 10 villages, then 20 villages, 100, 1,000, who's in charge of the towns, then has to have separate people that go around and see that all the other people are under him, and the villages are doing nicely. Then there's a minister that's separate from all of that that goes and checks that they're doing nicely. So it's all very much based on the human element. And in there it says that one should know that the people who take these responsibilities, very easily they go bad. So that is dealt with here. So it's all very personal in dealing with the people, and also in the nature, is that you don't want to be fighting during the rainy season. Ideally, everything should be quick. So now it'll discuss all the different aspects of the war. Is that he'll have to have arranged everything in his kingdom nicely, so that no problem will come. Then after that, then he has to see that everything for going out is ready, and that he is always, all his spies and everything's happening very nicely, so he knows what's going on. Then he must prepare his roads. Right? Means through marshy land, through forests, and through deserts, so he can move his armies properly. And then after he's done that, then he can, and the army, he must have that all ready. You know, your elephants, your horses, your chariots, then your foot soldiers, then here, the general, like that, the topmost of the army, he has to be secured. And then the workmen, because workmen do things, you know, they set up tents, they build roads, they do all these different things that you need to do. So when they're all there, then he can move. But now in this, you must also consider that when he moves from his capital, then he moves in a particular, let's say he moves to the east to fight on the eastern side of his kingdom. Now he has to watch that if he has an enemy in the west, he doesn't then invade and take his kingdom like this. So he must before that either have secured that very nicely with some other means, or he has a friend that's next to, between the two or just below, I mean just like to the south or to the north, that he will keep an eye on like that. The Sanskrit term means the enemy who will catch you by the heel. Is as you're going away, they'll catch you by the heel as you're not looking, you're looking in the other direction. So that's a Sanskrit term. So that enemy, that must be kept. You have to see that is kept in line. And then it mentions you go in different formations as you march. You know, one must keep discipline, but one must also be ready for any battle. So it depends upon if there's a long distance, whatever the roads, you may choose to be very long, going wide, going spearheads, going, what do you call it, like a diamond shape, like this, all these different things you can go, or opposite, like an hourglass, they call it a makara, like that. Okay. And then at night, then they sleep in what's called a lotus. That means you put the king in the middle, and then all your different rankings, you know, your higher ranks and lower on out to the outer edges is your, it'll be your foot soldiers and workers and all this kind of thing. Most essential in the middle. So that's how they'll spend their night. Then once he comes to the place, yeah, let's see. Yeah. Then it mentions, on the ground, let him fight with chariots and horses, in water-bound places with boats and elephants. Elephants like water. And, yeah. Yeah. And then, oh, here we go. And where there's ground covered with trees and shrubs, then he should fight with bows. Because then these others don't have any much meaning. Because then if it's covered by ground, you can hide inside that and you can shoot with bows and arrows. But the others, they won't move around properly. Then after he's arranged his troops, then it mentions that he should okay, then he should encourage them with some nice address, some kind of things that will be inspiring words. Then after he's inspired them, then he should go and check them. Because by checking, then everybody feels very ready. The king has come and saw that they're ready. So then there's a very tight mood there. And then after that, then he'll fight with the enemy. So we see very much that the commander, the king, must be involved in the whole process. It's very, very important. He can't just sit in some, you know, other place, but the Vedic system is that he himself, they're fighting for the king, so he should be the one encouraging them. He should be the one making the speeches and getting everyone enthused and coming and personally checking so that everybody can have that opportunity to reciprocate like that. And then he should also be, he should watch them how they fight. You should see what is their behavior, this and that, because then you actually know for the future who are your better men, who are your less better men. And the better men must always be recognized, must be given a position. Is there, just as we see in the village, you know that someone, the more responsibility they take, the more facility they get. So the more they get of tax, those are heads of villages. The more villages are watching, the more they get. Same time as you know they're corrupt, can be easily corrupted. Therefore, then the head of the area is always personally checking them, and you also have another set of ministers and his spies to check them also. So like that. So then you give them facility, which they want. You check them personally. That keeps them in line, and in case they're corrupt and being clever, it's more hidden, then your spies will detect that. So in this way, human nature is seen. So also here in the whole fighting, is they must see that. Who is the best fighters, who does are the most loyal, who behaves very properly, then he must do that. So when he comes to the place, the enemy's place, then he should shut his place up, and he must start to harass the kingdom. He should always ruin the grass, the fuel, the food, and the water. And then when inside, then there's a problem, then there'll be surrender. The king doesn't want to see his people suffer, so therefore doesn't want to see him suffer, so therefore then he'll surrender like that. Because these are the ways that you tell. It means if nothing else, if you can't do by fighting, you just sit there and you don't let anyone in or out, and then no one can come and get anything. So unless they're very well stocked inside like that, then there'll be a problem. One king even won a war like that. They had been, I forget how long, they had been under siege for like a year or more, even maybe a few years. It was some major kingdom, and the Mughals wanted to catch this kingdom. They were very desirous of getting this. So then, actually inside there was nothing left. It was everybody was getting, it was like, it was this was the end. Then they didn't know what to do. So then the minister said, let's go around, we'll find somebody with a very fat sheep. And they sent out, you know, people everywhere. And they found one guy, whatever he had, he fed to the sheep. He somehow or another liked his sheep. So it was very fat sheep. Very fat sheep. Then they brought it, the sheep, and then to the king, and then they put the king's mark on the sheep. Like that. And then they took it to the gate on the side where the enemy was. And then, you know, the gate opened, and then there was some noise and this and that, and you know, the sheep got away. Right? And then when the enemy saw, they had been sitting there camped out for so long, and they figured they starved them out, and they saw this huge fat sheep come out. Then they thought, well, these guys are better stocked than we thought. So then they packed up and left, because they couldn't sit there for that long. You know, they also have their limit how long the men are going to sit. So like this, it's very important to see that this is there. Plus, he must bother all the water tanks, anything on the outside edge of the palace, or I mean on the, what do you call it? The fort, you know, the ramparts and everything sticking up. You bother that, break that. You just basically just give trouble, you know. And then try to create rebellion with the peoples, you know, because they'll be dissatisfied or this or that. He has his spies, they'll go in and they'll start things and try to say things bad against the king, like this. Now it says that these are all the different ways, and then by alarm at night. They won't fight at night, but they always create some problem so that nobody sleeps properly, and, you know, just some anxiety, you know, like that. So then, then it says that all this is there, this is how you do the war. But better than having the war is you have all your army out there, you're posed, you've already harassed them a bit, better to talk and settle. Because in settling, then you know what the outcome is. But if you fight, you never know what the outcome is. Sometimes a very good army and a good arrangement is defeated by a lesser arrangement. So it's unsure. So one should never depend upon war. War is only used at the end. Nothing else works, then war is used. This is the standard things. Kings don't like to waste the time and the money and the manpower in the fighting. But they have no problem doing it if it's necessary. Okay. But if he's tried, you know, like this, he's tried speaking nicely, giving gifts, and creating dissension. And if none of that works, or using them separately, together, any combination, if none of that works, then war must be there. But if he can do it by any other political way, political means, come to a political settlement, that's the best. Then if once he's gained victory, then he must worship the Lord, he must honor the righteous Brahmanas, and then he must grant exemptions and let him cause promises of safety to be proclaimed. Means to the people in general, he must always be talking about protection, because then they'll go right in, they've defeated the other king, they'll enter the kingdom, and then they will, you know, be in a prominent position, then they will speak and say that everything, people will be protected, and that the exemptions are there, meaning that generally regular taxes have to be paid because people have lost so much in the war. It means whatever their stocks are, this and that, that they would normally have, then that has been used. So therefore, for some time, then there'll be no taxes, this and that. Then the people know they can regain what they've lost and they'll be protected. So the people in general are happy. Because that's the whole point, anyway, of a war, is to keep your own kingdom happy. Or if the next kingdom is bothering, then you stop that king, because it's the king that's bothering, not the people. So the king, then that is adjusted, And then, so the people aren't in anxiety. Or if it's seen that the people in the other kingdom are suffering because the king's no good, then they can go and take that kingdom. They may fight a improper ruler, remove him, and then establish proper government. So then the next thing is after the Brahmins, then he should see what are the desires of the people, and there he should place a relative of the vanquished ruler on the throne. I mean, someone from that royal family of that place, he should place on the throne. Ideally, he's looking for someone who would be favorable, like that, because many times in the politics, you know, sometimes you have, especially if they're not very proper, then there'll be... means if you're a righteous king, then the person you're fighting against is every chance they're not righteous, because generally a righteous king will not fight against another righteous king. They have no need to fight. Generally a king who's more aggressive and all that, he will try to fight the other king. Right? So that means if you're a righteous king, I mean an unrighteous king, there'll have been righteous members of the royal family who have been kind of like sidelined, either put in prison or not in the mainstream. So then naturally you'll find those righteous members and make them the rulers. Right? And for those who are unrighteous kings, or not say unrighteous, but more aggressive, they've conquered a righteous king, there's those who are more materialistic in the royal family, he'll find them and put them on the throne, because that way then the relationships will be. So because they've been put on the throne, naturally there's gratitude, and they have the protection of that other king, so then normally they should be friendly, but at least neutral. But if they're inimical, still they know that you are more powerful, and their whole supplies and everything have been reduced. So then there may be, you know, certain things are reduced. You know, they will take their taxes. So here, then after that, so it says here, then he will make authoritative the lawful customs of the inhabitants, just as whatever is there. See, normally you conquer another kingdom, they may have other customs, language, ways that they do things. You proclaim that this is all lawful, as long as it's, you know, supported by Shastra. You know, it may be the local customs, but it's not against Shastra. But that's allowed. Just like you see many times a king goes in, he conquers another kingdom, then he declares that local religion or lifestyle improper, and he tries to impose his own. Right? We see that it's very common. Like in Russia, they took all those countries around that became the CIS. Like that. Each one has a different language, different culture, different religion, everything. Because you see that they're bordering on the whole of Europe and Asia. You know, so on the western side, it's all Europe. Then he has the Middle East, which are all, you know, Muslims. The north was all Christians, you know. Then you come down and then you have the Asians, or like Chinese, the Mughals, all that. They have everything there. But they tried to establish, you know, one religion, one language, one everything, and no one ever appreciated that. So then as soon as Russia fell, they just went back, reverted back to whatever was their original thing. So that's the thing is, so the king, he knows that the people will be satisfied if what they are used to following, that's said to be lawful. So if they're accustomed to eating in a particular way, having marriages in a particular way, following particular, you know, customs, that's said to be legal, then they're very satisfied. So the point, the king must satisfy those people who he has conquered. He must satisfy them both by their lifestyles are accepted, and by seeing the wishes of the people, kind of who they have feeling towards for ruling the kingdom. Right? And the king himself must check, and the king's ministers must approve. These three must be there. The king himself must be satisfied with the ruler, those who are senior to him, the ministers of that country, his own ministers, they must be satisfied, and the people must be satisfied. Then you have a good ruler. So he's done all that. Then they've seized the desirable property, and by seizing that, it causes displeasure, and then by distribution that causes pleasure. So both are recommended. So depending on what needs to be done, someone's not in line, you seize the property, and then that can cause dissension amongst the inhabitants of that kingdom, or it can get that king to be a little bit more properly behaved. Then when things are proper, then that is given. Right? Then everybody will be very satisfied that they've gotten something. The people have gotten lands, the others. So like this, so much charity and all that's given. So you come in like that, very giving protection, shelter, understanding their difficult position, so exempt from taxes for some time. Then setting them up with a proper ruler, establishing, legalizing their, or authorizing their local customs, and giving land. So all this is being done by the new king. He can't just come in, steal everything, and then walk off. That's not a good king. You know, so therefore, you know, even though in, you know, modern history we may say so many great kings, but unfortunately they would rule in this way. They just go in and pillage and burn and wipe out and, what do you call it, raise to the ground. I always wondered why they call it raise to the ground, or whatever it is. You know, but this is not a righteous king. This is not a proper king. Vedic thing is that the people of the citizens of the country have nothing to do with the war. The war is for the king, his army. They are the ones that engage in the war. The people should not be distressed. That is there. They should not be distressed, right? And yeah. Says here is that then, in regarding the king who may catch from behind, is that gaining a friend is more important than wealth. Like that, land and gold is valuable, but then if you live in the midst of all kinds of people who you can't trust, neighboring kingdoms who are waiting for any opportunity to steal it all, one cannot be satisfied. Therefore, then gaining a friend, a firm friend, is important. Even if he's weak, the other king may not be so strong, but he may become strong with time. If he runs his kingdom nicely, then it will prosper. He may become very powerful, right? Because who knows how, what is due to someone like that. Anything may happen. Someone who's very powerful may become weak. Someone who's weak may become powerful. So therefore, a loyal friend who is righteous and grateful, then whose people are contented, because of he may be a friend, but if his people aren't happy, then there may be rebellion and he'll be thrown out anyway. Yeah. Like that. And then of foes, then the worst is someone who is wise, noble, brave, clever, liberal, grateful, and firm. Because that person then can be a very formidable enemy. He's very properly behaved. His people will support him. He'll have so many other kings supporting him. That's the worst enemy. In other words, don't fight a very qualified, righteous king. That's the worst person to make an enemy. Then a neutral then is someone who behaves properly, has knowledge of men, knows how they behave, compassionate disposition, and are liberal. Then like that, then it's good. Like that. But someone who is very clever and noble and wise, they're worse. Someone who is just, you know, good, that's okay. But someone who's excellent, he's the worst. Like that. So then it says that here means that the king, for the proper protection of the state, yeah, because a king on his own, the nature of a king, they can restart anything. You have one king, you take him into any place, he can start a new kingdom. Because they know how to do it, just like you have a Brahmin. He knows all the mantras, he knows all the ritual, he knows the philosophy, he knows the scriptures. You put him anywhere, and he can perform his duties, and he can train others. Like that, because what he has is with him. So a lone Brahmin can go and start a whole thing. So the same way you have a king. On his own, he can actually start a whole state. Because he knows how to do it. He knows the art. He knows the science. Like that. So the king must protect himself. That's his duty. While he's king, he must protect himself. If he's vanaprastha, has gone to the forest, then he doesn't worry about it. Like that. He doesn't worry for these things. He leaves his weapons, everything, and goes. And then it's up to the Lord. But while he's a king and performing the duties of a king, he must protect himself. So it mentions here that he can give up without hesitation than a country which is very, very, celebrated country, fertile, and has an increase of cattle. In other words, very prosperous. He can give that up for his own protection. Then in times of need, he must preserve his wealth. But at the expense of wealth, let him preserve his wife. Let him at all events preserve himself. Yeah. So, and if there's some misfortune is very violently comes up, very difficult comes up, then he must try to use all these different avenues of politics. You know, sama, dana, beta, danda. He must try to use all those like that. This does not mean cowardly. This means just a matter of he has to see what is going to be best for his kingdom. Just like, Chandragupta. He fought with Nanda, but his strategy and his army wasn't great enough. So then he retreated. You know, it wasn't, when you've been challenged to a fight, then the king won't turn, will not leave. But if it's not, he hasn't been challenged in fight, just the men are fighting and this and that, he sees it's not going well and there's a problem, then he may call a retreat. But if he's been engaged personally in battle, that he won't turn from, right? No Kshatriya will turn from that. Otherwise, as it was mentioned, if he turns from the fight, then if he's, you know, like that, then the person that who has won, he gets all the pious credits of that Kshatriya. And then the other person takes on the impious of the person who defeated him, right? But if he, you know, stands and fights, even if he loses, then he goes, he gets all the benefit of all his pious credits, like that. So kings, there's no advantage. They're not, because they know they're not the body, so it's not worth saving the body at the loss of all your piety and taking on the bad qualities of the other king. It's not, what's the purpose? So this means is that they see it's improper, so they retreat. You know, or they see it's going to be improper, the other side's too powerful, so then they make a deal. Okay, we'll be surrendered king, we'll serve under your protection, we'll pay taxes, we'll help you in times of war, like this. So that may be, so he must do whatever he must do for this. Because then even if he loses so much, a king knows how to again create all this, because passion, so he knows how to re-manifest all these. He knows the science. So now, these are all, okay. Yeah, so now these are all the things he discusses. He's going to discuss the law. He's going to discuss the protection of the kingdom. He's going to discuss war. These are all what he discusses with his ministers. So now this has been what he discusses and how they would, because they would discuss all these things. Is the army ready? Do we have all our six aspects of the army? Do we have our general? Do we have this? Do we have that? How can we make peace? How the spies are doing? All these different things. So this is their discussion. So now we've just come out of their discussion. Now it goes back. Then having thus consulted with his ministers on all these matters, having taken exercise, and having bathed afterwards, The king may enter the inner chambers of the palace at midday in order to take his lunch. So this is what's all happened before lunch. All this kind of discussion. This is why it's called passion. Is all this has happened. So he's gotten up, taken his bath, done his morning sadhana, then entered his court, taken care of all the law. After that, discussed with the ministers all these things that we've just been discussing for so many days. After that, then a little exercise like that, taken his bath. Then he goes into the inside of the palace where the family members are, the wife and the other members of the family. And he takes his noon meal. Then he takes food which has been prepared by faithful, uncorruptible servants who know the purpose and proper time for dining. So they know what to cook at what times, the different seasons, what goes with what. You know, they know the science very, very well. You know, they know health, they know everything. So they know how to adjust everything perfectly. Like that. Which has been well examined. Means the food has been well examined and hallowed by sacred texts that destroy poison. Means that the different texts that deal with all that, then whatever must be done, like that. Then he mixes his food with various kinds of medicines that will counteract any kind of poisons, like that. He wears gems that will counteract poisons, like that. And those who are serving, all the maid servants and everything like that, they must be those who are have been tested well. Then before they're doing their service, the place where they dress and everything, you know, that must be checked very nicely, that there's no poisons or weapons or anything there. And then all their ornaments have been checked, because you have these rings and they open and things fall out of them and all, you know, all the stuff you see in the movies, but that's what reality. Maybe when it goes into the drink, it doesn't make all the fizzy little bubbles because it's not sodium bicarbonate they're dropping in, it's actually poison. But for the movie, it must make bubbles, otherwise you don't know what's going on. But in the real life, they don't want to know what goes on, so it doesn't make bubbles. Like that. So, like that. Everything must be checked. Their place and their ornaments, they've been tested, observed for, you know, a long time, so they're well-trusted. But even though they're well-trusted, doesn't mean that they're not still being constantly guarded, checked. Like that. So in this way, the same way, like his food, he must be careful about his carriages, his bed, his seat, his bath, his toilet, and all his ornaments also. There's nothing in his ornaments, there's not something wrong with the ornaments, they don't have some trick things that go off or, you know, things like that. Then after he's taken his meal, then he diverts his attention, then he spends time with the family, talking to their wives, doing all these different things like that. And then after diverting himself in this way, he must again in due time think of the affairs of the state. So he can't get lost in that all day and just spend the rest of the day. No, he takes his lunch, they relax, they talk, discuss this, that, take a little rest and that. But towards the, you know, later in the afternoon, again he must turn his attention to the state. Then adorned with his robes of state, means then dressed very nicely. Means in the morning he's dressed properly, but not too fancy. Because if he goes sit in the court, then he should be dressed very, you know, dignified, but not overly ornamented. Business-like. Yeah, it's more, yeah, business-like, you know. Otherwise, it's too much. You know, you've come there, the people that have come with complaints, they're supposed to be the center of attention. The king gives the decision. But now in the afternoon, now he adorns in robes of the state, you know, really dresses up very nicely. Then he goes and inspects the fighting men. He inspects the armies. So the armies gather in the evening and all that. He inspects the armies. He goes and sees their place. So amongst the army, amongst the men, then he dresses very nicely and he's the king. Like that. Checks the men, his chariots. Says all his chariots and beasts of burden. He checks everything to make sure there's nothing wrong. Everything's in very good shape. All the horses are in shape. All the men are in shape. Everything. All the weapons and all the accoutrements that go with this. Then, so this takes him up until the evening, the sunset. Then at sunset, then he performs his evening the, you know, chanting of the Gayatris and all these kind of things. You know, at noontime he took his bath, he'll do that, take his lunch in the morning, he's already done that. So in the evening, he stops for that. So here, big manager stops for his sandhyas. This is a very important thing to put into any management lectures, is that once the sun goes down, or if you're in some highly impious place where the sun doesn't go down, at a particular normal regulated time, you know, like between 6 and 7 o'clock, that's it. Business of management stops. That's it. No Aryan continues past that time. Madmen, yes. Aryans, no. Like that. It's just a rule. The king stops. If it's emergency, of course, that's another thing. It mentions he can even be discussing with his ministers in solitude at midnight. If he thinks that's the time he can discuss very serious things when no one's around, everyone's asleep. Emergency is another thing. But regular, normal meetings, right, which should basically be all meetings, you know, then they must end in the evening. And then you can perform your evening sadhana like this. That must be done, and it stops at that time. So his main management and all is all in the morning, all the heavy management's in the morning. Then a little bit in the afternoon, but that's generally more practical. That's all internal, you know, his own armies. The palace and his armies, while the morning is for the people. Morning is his people, evening is his own, you know, his own, what's happening inside, other than the ministers, but, you know, what's inside, inside management. Then after he has done his evening Gayatris and all that, says then, having performed his twilight devotions, let him, well armed, here in an inner apartment, the doings of those who make secret reports and have spies, and probably his email. So that's the time when you, in other words, but you'll notice it is after the Gayatri has been chanted, like that. Nothing is so, how interesting it will be to hear from your spies what is going on in the kingdom. But first he has chanted his Gayatri. Then he will take care of all these things. Like that. Then is all the secret reports at the inner time. So after he's done all that, public appearance, done all his Gayatris and everything like that, then he will not be necessarily in the robes of the state, but he'll be well armed. And he'll go to his inner apartments, and then he will hear from them different things. Yeah, so then after dismissing, dismissing the those who have come, either the ministers or, you know, his spies or common people who have come with some information, then at that time, then he can go back with the family, with the queens, and and then take his evening meal. So it says here, having eaten there something for the second time, that meant he did his morning work and then went straight into, did his morning sadhana and went straight into work, and then ate lunch. Then did his afternoon work, evening sadhana, hearing any special reports, then it stops, then he takes his evening meal. So like that. So the king is basically only eating two full meals. There may be a morning snack. You know, some milk, some fruit, any, basically not something of greatly substantial. That's not considered eating. Milk, fruit, these things are not considered, how you say, eating. Taking grains means a meal, like that. A snack is not a meal. So there may be something in the morning, there may not be. But noon and evening, then he properly takes his meals. So like that, depending upon, so this is how, in other words, he's not eating three times full meals. Otherwise, his health will go, he'll become fat, you know, he won't be able to function properly, you know. After you take a big meal in the morning, you can't sit there and make judgments, you know. You just can't do it. It's not possible. You have to have a clear head, so clear head means light stomach. Therefore, you understood. Yeah, okay. So, then after eating, Then he hears some music and everything like that. And then after music and that, his mind becomes peaceful. Then it says you must take rest and rise at the proper time, free from fatigue. So you can't go to bed too late. You can't have eaten too heavy. You can't have, you know, spent all night talking with the wives, all this and that. He has to take rest at a proper time, you know. In other words, the whole day we see. It starts off in the morning, very sattvic. Then he gets into all the judgments and that, which means you have to be very much in the mode of goodness and judging like that. Then he moves more as noon comes, towards the noontime. That's when the mode of passion comes up. According to the days, according to Ayurveda and in astrology, is from sunrise up to around 10, 10:30, like that, depends upon the place. Then to a little bit before the middle of the day, that time is controlled by air, or the mode of goodness. So it's very good for quick decisions, quick, you know, anything with thinking, putting things together, dissecting things. In other words, hearing philosophy, doing sadhana, dealing with judgments, anything that's very, uses a lot of intelligence. Then we see then around, then just before noon at that, then it goes into bile or passion. And it will stay up in that until the evening. So then, means a late afternoon. So then at that time, that's when he starts getting into the heavy politics of the state and the managements and all these kind of things like this. Then he takes his lunch, spends time in the family, you know, resting a little bit like that. And then in the evening time, then it moves into kapha, or it moves into ignorance in the day. So then that's the time. Ignorance means the ego, this, that. Morning means goodness, not so much ego. So therefore he's dressed very simply in the morning. Like that afternoon, that's when he puts on all his fancy stuff and goes out and cuts the profile, right? So, you know, and inspires everybody and their egos and their, you know, all these different things like that. Then we see then it starts to wind down again. He does his sadhana and then again some lighter things like that, because then is the evening. Then it starts off with the kapha, and that's the time to, you know, in the evening, first light things, not so, you know, you hear some things, but you'll discuss it very seriously the next day. Unless it's some emergency, then you may call the ministers and then you may meet until midnight. That's another. But a normal thing, you hear what's going on in the state, this, that, and if there's something to discuss, you'll discuss it tomorrow. But you've heard, so you know what's going on. He's informed. He's well informed. Now, there's twice a day he's well informed what's happening in the state. Then he'll have his meal, sit and discuss a little bit, so that will get lighten things, hear some music, then that will make everything very peaceful and very nice. Then he'll, into that calm state, take rest. He won't be in anxiety and all that. Then in the morning he'll wake up refreshed. If he's not refreshed, how his brain's going to work the next morning for running the state, doing his judgments in the court and dealing with the ministers and the management of the kingdom. Like that. So he must be well rested, free from fatigue. And then it says, the last verse is, a king who is in good health must observe these rules. He must observe. But if he is indisposed, he may entrust all this business to his servants. In other words, the ministers and other things like this, they may take care of all this if he is indisposed. Health is not good, or, you know, he's like Shantanu, he's lamenting too much because he's, you know, seen, what do you call it? What's her name? Matsyaganda. I only know that name. What's the other one? Satyavati. Satyavati, yeah. Satyavati, and, you know, he wants to marry her, but he doesn't want, you know, to see Bhishma not be on the throne. So, like that, at that time, the ministers, they're running the place because he's too much, you know, how you say, overwhelmed by the emotions of having a nature that is so steeped in passion. So at that time, so either health or these kind of things, or like when he goes off to hunt, you know, in other words, when the king always gets himself in trouble, right? Pariksit Maharaj was hunting, got so tired and thirsty, then he wanted water he didn't get from the sage. That's why it said that hunting is one of the downside of the king. They get so much into the sport, right? Sport, right? The modern thing is sport is such a great thing, develops all finer things, right? Wasn't that what the thing said? Is all the sport will develop the finer, huh? Cooperation, yeah, cooperation, like Somaka Rishi and King Pariket, you know, great cooperation. And all these things are developed by sport, right? We can see practically, you know, all throughout history, the sport is, you know, like in England, you know, the soccer hooligans and the other, the people on the other side, the other, you know, spectators. There's, you know, cooperation. They both try to kill each other. It's a very, very common thing. So sport, if one gets too overly into it, then it is a great problem, because so many bad things come up from that. So one must be, therefore Krishna says, one who is regulated in eating, sleeping, work, and recreation. Then it works nicely. So here it says recreation is there, whatever is needed to make the mind peaceful. That's the function of it. The king, there's been so much happening in the state, the pressure is, so he may go out into the forest, go on a walk, or go out hunting, or, you know, just do something. Go to a holy place, something to take his mind off. He leaves it with the other members of the state, ministers and that, for some time, so that the mind will be peaceful, then he can function. It's a purpose of recreation. And we see in the work, it's very nicely balanced. This day is very clearly marked out. The best times of the day for what activity is being done, right? He's not listening to music during the day, he's listening in the evening. Right? He does. Otherwise, it's a waste of time. In the morning, his brain is fresh. Then he could be solving, you know, civil cases, or discussing with the ministers and making the plans for how to run the state. You know, he can be checking his facilities, you know, the royal facilities and the army and all that. He can be seeing that's all in line. So only in the evening then that kind of stuff is done. And if he deals with the ministers, all these things of what's going on and all the inside things, the more political matters, then the mind becomes too passionate and it's very hard to sit still to make judgments in the mode of goodness. So we see that everything has its time and it's well thought out and it functions. And if you read, then even saintly kings, or practically you can say, actually the saintly kings, they follow this. You see, Yudhishthira is the same thing. When he'd get up in the morning on the Battle of Kurukshetra, he'd wake up to some music, singing, dancing, go take his bath, put on some fresh, you know, clean white silks, no ornaments in that, then go do the yajnas, see the Brahmins, give in charity. So that sadhana he's doing even on the battlefield, right? Let alone on a regular day. On the battlefield he's doing that. And after he's done all that, then he'll put on his armor and everything, and then the business of the day. So normal business of the day for a king is solving all the difficulties in the kingdom, the justice. That's the normal. Then secondary is dealing with the ministers, this, that, because if everything's running nicely, the report should be good, or they're discussing good work. But at the same time, is they always have to keep their eye on the political pulse, what's happening in the other kingdoms. That must always be there. It's the earlobe. Yeah. Seven rivers are in the earlobe, not in the ear. The right ear of an initiated Brahmin. Someone who's not initiated, there's no rivers living there. Like that. Okay. Yeah. So like this, these principles of how to work a day, this is how managers should function. We also have that. We have our morning sadhana. There may be some little bit of, you know, getting some practical work done if there, especially if you're in a community where things may start early. But if you're in a temple, things start later. So then after the morning program, that's when then the serious all work and dealings and management and all the very heavy stuff is done. And once that's done, people can work. Then he'll sit with people who he can the confidence and discuss so many different things. Like that. You know, taking his lunch, resting a little bit in the afternoon, spending time with those who are close, intimate, who he appreciates being with, you know, either family members, friends, like this. Then the evening again, he'll take care of, you know, ordinary dealings and that. In other words, the ordinary dealings are in the afternoon, in the evening time. You know? Like that, deal with all that kind of stuff. If there's stuff for his own personal stuff, he'll do that in the afternoon. The affairs of the state are first, and then the afternoon is private. like that. So if he has to deal things, budgets in the family and problems at home and all that, that'll be done in the afternoon. You know? That's all done in the afternoon. The morning, the best time of the day is given for the service. That means managing. Not his personal management. Who he is in charge of? Who is his dependents? What is his sphere of influence? That's very important. Like that. Otherwise, you know, taking the wife to the doctor and going out and getting this shoes for the kid and all that. And everybody wants, you know, to do something, but the president's gone out and taken the car, and that's not allowed. Vedas don't allow that. He can do that in the afternoon. Right? Shops are open until 7 o'clock, so he can easily do it in the afternoon. Morning is for the temple devotees, the community, whatever business and management must be done, serious things like this, and all the overall dealings and all that, all the big work. And then the afternoon is all the smaller, private, going around and inspecting everything in the temple, seeing that the kitchen's clean and the deity stuff is put away nicely, and all these different things like that. So that like this, then they must be careful. He's writing there. You should always be conscious of your surroundings. Okay. Are there any questions on this? Because that finishes the specific duties of the king, his general schedule and duties. Yes. Oh, yes. There's actually more. The brahmana is because you have... See, it, basically it's... What's happening in here is that whatever is the best place to explain something, you explain that there. Just like here, the schedule of management. Now, who is... Of all the varnas and ashrams, who is the manager? Right? It's the married kshatriya. He is the epitome of management. So anything that you want to explain about management... It will be explained through the medium of the king, because then you see it in its full form. But now, this same thing is how you want to run an ashram, or run the brahmachari ashram, or run your sankirtan party, or anything, any management that you have to do, run your house, you'll use the same principles. The same principles are there. This is management. Then when it discusses about the brahmachari, it discusses how to deal with the teacher, how to study, you know? Like that. So that grihasthas and everybody, all occupations are studying and have a spiritual master or have teachers. So how you deal with them is all in the same way as the brahmachari does. That same mood and those same elements must be there. So the epitome of study and menial service is the brahmachari. So all aspects are studied there. Then the grihastha, how you interact with the whole society, how you deal all that, that is done there. So that applies to everybody who deals with society. So everybody must take from all the others, but one must know also specifically what is their thing, you know, like that. You know, I mean, the father in the house doesn't have to put on a sword and, you know, put on all his medals and everything and then go around to, you know, inspect, you know, his tools in the tool shed in the evening or something. You know, I mean, it's not necessary like that. You know, make all the wife and kids stand in a line and the dog at the end there and come to inspect. You know, it doesn't need to be done. So one understands that specifically applies to the kshatriya. In other words, the detail you may leave, but the principle and its purpose, that has to be taken. Otherwise, you haven't understood the sacred law. That's generally what's happening, is people will read it, take it out of context, or what they apply it. These rules only apply to kshatriyas. These only to brahmins. These only to this. So they think that they end up with totally different cultures. There's one homogenous culture. And everybody is following their aspect of it, their emphasis of it. Like that. So they're just like a young student. He is listening to the teacher, he is taking his notes, he is doing his homework. But it will be very light. But someone who is older and they're in deeper studies, it'll be the same things, but it'll be much different. He'll have more books, more work to do, more things to write. He may be more working on his own, less with the teacher. But there's still respect for the teacher, the dealings, how he'll do his studies, it's the same. So if the PhD candidate thinks, well, all I have to do is keep a box of crayons, you know, like that, and some Play-Doh, you know, edible, and you know, some you know, really heavy fat pencils, you know, with a clown at the end. And, you know, I only had one notebook in first grade. That's all I need now. You know, you go to your class like that, and when your mentor sees you, then he may think that he may talk to the, you know, the vice chancellor of the university that maybe they should reconsider your application, you know, like this. So the detail, but the principle is there. You have your things, how you're going to collect your information, how you're going to get your information, how you're going to study your information, that remains. That's the principle. But the detail changes. So the whole point of the Vedic culture is get one beyond the externals to the internal. Right? So even though it's just mundane social management, its purpose is to get from the gross to the subtle. The living entity, by being in the material world so long, has gone from the subtle to the gross. Right? He's only interested in the senses and his position and all facilities and all that. All gross what he sees around him. But the whole Vedic culture is to get one's attention from that onto the subtle. Right? So, therefore, the Vedic culture works so perfectly with devotional service. That's why the Acharyas, when they talk about culture, you'll always see them use Varnashram. Right? It's not that it's the only word in Sanskrit to mean somehow or another how to interact with people, social development and economic prosperity and all that. They have a lot of other words, but somehow or another the Acharyas always choose this term, Varnashram, and specifically Daiva Varnashram. Because Varnashram system is to help take the gross elements that we're dealing with our senses and mind and intelligence, and transform that into subtle. What's behind it? What's its purpose? What are the subtleties? How to work with subtleties? How to understand the principle and be able to apply it in unlimited different ways? So the gross culture is so perfectly tuned to this because that's its spiritual application, because that's what it's for. Varnashram is actually meant for devotees only. It's not meant for the karmis and jnanis, but they make some adjustments for them so they can also follow and be benefited. Because if they're subtle, you might be able to one day say something and they catch it. And then they take up devotional service. Right? That's the purpose of it. Therefore, we find sometimes difficulties in engaging aspects of modern culture. Because it takes subtle to gross. Whatever you do must increase desire, which means then there must be some result afterwards. Right? Right? Just like the Vedic psychology is to understand what is behind. You have a disturbance. What is behind it? Because we have material desire, and that desire is separate from Krishna. Therefore, we have their problem. We have, therefore, too much attachment or too much hatred. We have to learn to balance that. That is the point of the Vedic psychology, is to get one to come back to the philosophy and then bring your life in line with that philosophy. Well, the modern is you look at, you're having some difficulty. Well, let's look at how you're using your senses. What? You're following four regulative principles? This is your problem. Because you're restricting yourself and you're not allowing yourself to do whatever you like. Therefore is the problem. So if you just lead a more free life, do what you like to do, don't restrict yourself, then you'll be more satisfied. So they use the subtle to create gross. But the Vedic is you use the subtle to transform the attention from gross to subtle. And from that subtle, it's very easy to understand, much more easy to understand in relationship to the Absolute Truth. So this is the purpose here. So we can see the Vedic culture is perfectly tuned to assist the Pancharatrik and the Bhagavat processes. That's what it was manifest for, no other reason. You know? Like that. But it's going to be very strange if you have a handful of devotees following it and everybody else being animals. So therefore, it's adjusted in such a way that the whole world can follow it. Therefore, the devotees then can move very comfortably in the world and perform their devotional activities. because everybody's following the culture. Right? Therefore, there's a problem nowadays. Previously, you didn't have a problem. Everybody wore dhotis and saris. Right? And they did wear saris. Like that, it's a popular thing nowadays to say, oh, sari is a Muslim thing. It was introduced by them, you know, the covering the head, wearing the sari. So therefore, we can throw it out and go back to our, you know, jeans and tank tops. Like that. You know? But the point, huh? And that's, I'm talking both sides, men and women. But that wasn't a fact, you know. They used to wear saris before, like that, like the South Indian sari they've been wearing since a long time before the Mughals came. The Mughals never got south, you know. But they don't bother with the five meter sari, you know, because then it only goes on kind of once and it falls off easily. They wear a 9 meter sari. There's no way that's going to fall off like that. You know, so it's also, those things are there. And then in the north, and they would also wear, you see the gopis, how they're dressed, they're wearing saris, like that. But along with the sari, they're also wearing a skirt. That's the difference. They're wearing a sari plus a skirt. Well, what appears, if the historians are correct, is the Mughals developed where you mix the skirt and the sari are made into one piece. You have a little bit longer sari and include the skirt, right? Then you end up with the modern North Indian saris, you know, like that. So we have to be very, very careful that we understand the Vedic culture and how broad it is, how very, very well thought out, how easily it can be applied if we know the principles. If we don't know the principles, it becomes very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. Yes.
What did young girls wear? Did they wear saris or something?
If we look at the principles of it, then we can understand it. We don't look at the principles, we have a problem. Generally, traditionally, the young girls wouldn't so much wear. It means those who were not married didn't wear the sari. Sari was the right of a married girl. Covering the head was a right of a married girl. So therefore, when a girl was of age and she didn't have her head covered, then naturally the whole community thinks there must be something either wrong with her or her family, or father's useless. Some fiasco has happened, therefore no one will marry the girl, or she's has bad qualities, therefore no one will marry. So having an uncovered head of a girl of age is a great embarrassment, right? But nowadays it's considered it's a right. And it's a great problem for covering the head. But in the Vedic, it was the opposite. So that meant that the girl was married at any of, I think, 3 or 4 times. I can't remember all the names. The name that we generally hear, the kanya. Kanya means 11, 12-year-old. Like that. Just at the cusp of puberty. Generally, it's just before. Like that, is that they would generally be married before they hit puberty, if they're having just one marriage. Just before, or just after. That's a kanya. Then a girl older than that, when she hits her teens and she starts to unravel, that's considered like the last, you know, that's considered not very good. And then before kanya, then that would be those girls who are wanting to be married, they would generally be married at that time. Previously, they would be married when they're, you know, they might be married when they're 5, 6, 8 years old. But they wouldn't live at the husband's house. They would still live with their father. But they're already married. They know who the husband are. They would already be wearing their saris and all that. And, huh? Yeah, yeah. Because it was their right. And then you know, here's a nice girl. A girl that's 8 years old and is already married. You know, this is a high-class family, well-organized, and she must be very highly qualified herself that others are willing to marry her. So therefore, even the later age, the kanya is like a bit late. And then when they, you know, so that's why when Prabhupada's wife his daughter was 14. And his wife came to him and said, you either get her married now or I jump off Howard Bridge. Because how long can the wife go on tolerating all the gossip that goes around the circle of the women that her daughter must be bad? Right? Either the daughter's bad, the family's bad, the father's bad, you know, or the wife's husband is bad. Somebody's bad. That's the reason she's not married. How long she can tolerate. Therefore, 14 is about the limit. Like that. Plus, you know, the girl will be, you know, highly unraveling by that time. So it's natural, like that. So we can see is this whole thing, what did they wear? There wasn't so much of a problem before, like that, of this kind of thing. So that would be there. Then the girls who would rightfully get married later, means that at like 12, they wouldn't marry earlier, was generally only reserved for Brahmin girls who wanted to study. Then they would study either in their father's gurukul or an uncle or some relative's, you know, family gurukul. And they would study the subjects of the boys. But then when she came of age, then she'd get married. She just would live in the house because the gurukul is not, this is not a gurukul that's run by a sannyasi. This is a family member. So she would live as part of that family. And she would just sit at the side or the back of the class and hear what's going on. Like that, because everything was taught orally anyway. So she would just hear in this way, and she would study this way. And then, so she didn't go through the two marriages. She would just go through the one when she came of age. But other girls, the Kshatriyas many times, and the others, they would get married younger. That was the normal thing. Otherwise, like Rukmini, she was 12, right? She's 12. She can already, you know, hold down a palace. 12 years old, she can manage a palace. You know, nowadays it's 11, 12 year old girl, they're so young and they're just little girls and all that. But that's just due to lack of training. The trained girls at 12, they could run a house. Rukmini could run a palace. Right? Like that. She could maintain her character. You know, Draupadi, same. Like this, very highly qualified. Therefore, Swayamvara was only for very, very highly qualified girls. Highly qualified. And Kshatriyas at that. Nobody else did Swayamvara. Only Kshatriyas.
Is it coming of age?
Yeah, coming of age, and they were very highly qualified. Because then they know what to look for. They're looking for. When they're younger, someone else picks for them. But when, if they're doing the Swayamvara, then naturally they have to have come of age. Otherwise, they don't fully understand what they're getting themselves into. So therefore, you wouldn't have any girl basically past 11 or 12 that wasn't wearing a sari or didn't have wasn't dressed. So the difficulty comes up nowadays because of just, at least in India, because of the modern, what do you call it? Yeah, modern situation. The British changed the laws and all that. And in the Western situation, you can't, the girl, even though she's serious at 12 years old about marriage, because they have this concept that they must associate with those who are of equal age, boys of equal age, the boys are useless till they're about 18. So that means 6 years of insanity. You know, like that they have to go through. You know, and then they can get married. So it just creates a very unnatural, disturbing time. Like that. You know, we're talking with those who have grown up, samskar has been trained in these things and all that. And then for them it's not a problem. Because the relationships in the family are very tight, very nice, and very, and deal very, very well. What time is it? 10:15. 10:20. Any other questions? Sir? Yes. What would they wear? It depends. Because generally they're in the house. They wouldn't be out in public. You know, and in the house, they'd wear anything. You know, if it was hot in the summer, they would just wear their underpants. That's all. They wouldn't have to wear anything else. When they're, you know, little kids who are in a real spa below, like, you know, 4 years old, they walk around with nothing on, there's no problem. They just, you know, wear any kind of cloth. Didn't really matter. It didn't matter. It means the main thing was in the Vedic cultures, once they hit puberty, that's when they should be dressed properly. Because that dress is meant for it. It complements, you know, what they look like when as they develop, like that. Yes. Yes. Yes, there's the different levels of realization are there, and sometimes the different standards. But see, when I'm saying about the Vedic culture, I mean Daivavarnashram. So that means you're dealing with Aryans. We're not dealing with, you know, Shudras who want to eat meat and are taking their black goats out at midnight and killing them. We're not talking about that. We're not talking about, you know, so many of these kind of aspects. We're talking about those who are serious about advancing in spiritual life. So then they have a basic common culture of that principle. Because in all of the things in the Dharma Shastras as it mentions, there's all kinds of, how you say, compromises that can be there. Or not compromises, say commissions. You know, you can do something, but in a concessions. But always after describing that section, then it mentions that it's best that that's not done. If you really want some serious thing, don't do that. So that's the Daiva Varnashram. And if you take it, that's the Asuric Varnashram. So in the Asuric Varnashram, then you'll see that the basic fundamental principles are followed the same for everyone. Right? How the Brahmin deals with his wife, Kshatriya with his wife, everybody deals the same. How they deal with their children, how they deal with their relatives, how they respect the guru or respect the parents. Like that, that always remains. But more major customs of the family may be very different. But in the Daivavarnashram, then you don't see so much difference because the Daivavarnashram is based on the devotional principles. So then that means the Brahminical culture becomes the common culture. Though there may be, you know, slightly regional differences in food and language and all that kind of thing. But that's very minimal. The main thing that's happening is that the basic principles of cleanliness, respect of authority, sense control, all the things that one learns as a brahmachari, those are maintained by everybody. Like that. And especially when you come into very serious devotees, then that you know, who are interested in performing, you know, devotional service for the Lord's pleasure, then that has to be on the platform of goodness. So the culture that applies to the Brahmins is the common culture. Even if by nature they're a Shudra and doing Shudra occupational duties, it doesn't matter. They're a serious devotee who does everything for the Lord's pleasure, then they are Brahmins. Though they have the body, mind, and intelligence that fit Shudra activities, so they do those activities for Krishna. But their consciousness is not that of a Shudra. So you only get this difference of consciousness really in the Asuric Varnashram. Or you can get it to a subtle degree in the Daiva Varnashram, but that is based on you doing your work for Krishna, but you want the fruits. You enjoy the fruits. And then you give some of those fruits to Krishna. But when you understand the fruit is Krishna's, right? In other words, Sakam to Nishkam. At that time, then there is only one that the culture that is very solid. Then all you only see difference in occupational duties, and then the main difference that you'll see. I mean, that's in just their movements, but the understanding of respect is according to Kanista Madhyamutam, you know, or other things that are there. You know, a temple president naturally be respected. you know, sannyasi or guru or GBC or senior devotee in the temple or the person who made you a devotee, you know, like that. Your own parents, like these kind of things. That kind of thing is always there, but that's common for everybody. Right? Another temple president has to also respect another temple president. Right? A Brahmin, when a Brahmin comes to his house, he has to respect him and treat him as a Brahmin. He can't think, well, I'm a Brahmin, I don't have to do that stuff. No, it's not that when a Brahmin goes to a Kshatriya Vaishya Shudra's house, then he's respected as a Brahmin. When he goes to a Brahmin's house, he's not. No, he has to still be respected as a Brahmin. The Brahmin can't even kill himself because the body is that, and the subtle and gross body is that of a Brahmin. So if he kills himself, commits suicide, then he gets a reaction of killing a Brahmin. So let alone everybody else has to deal with him as a Brahmin. You know, he can't even himself not deal with himself as a non-Brahmin. Like that. So the devotee then has to behave so that the culture then becomes common because the values are common. You want to go back to Godhead. But these other things, these are side things. You need to get married. For marriage, you need some kind of economic development. In that, you're going to be engaging the senses. Right? Those things are secondary. They're not major importance. They're just taken care of. Right? Like you eat, you pick things in your mouth and you chew. But you're not concentrating on the chewing, you know? Like that. Or on the swallowing, or, you know. You know, you're concentrating on the atmosphere, the association that's there, the taste of the prasad, what it looks like, all those things. The chewing and swallowing is secondary. You know? So in the same way as the devotional activities, the devotional sadhana, the mood in which I perform all of my activities, whatever they may be, that's predominant. That's mukya. Gona is, okay, I do this service or that service depending upon my nature. You know, I live in this ashram or that ashram depending upon my nature. That's just a conditioned nature. That's secondary. But it must be attended to. It must be attended to. It can't be neglected. Just like you can't not chew and not swallow and say you've eaten. You can say, well, that's secondary. We don't bother with that, you know. We'll just look at the food and talk about it and associate with each other. You know, we won't bother chewing it and swallowing. It's all secondary. But unfortunately, that's what we've done with the Vedic culture. Lord Chaitanya says it's external, and it's discussed with Ramananda Roy, but that doesn't mean it's not done. Lord Chaitanya himself was an exceedingly strict sannyasi. So if it was so external, why did he bother with it? Even when he's, you know, in the Gambhira. He's not going to deal in other ways. He's there, he hears one of the Devi Dasis singing in Jagannath Mandir. He's running there to hear the voice because they're singing Gita Govinda and all that. And then Subdhamana stops and says, no, it's a woman singing. You know? So they, oh, you've saved my life. Doesn't matter. He's in ecstasy, bhav, all these things. We don't care for the rules. No. Lord Chaitanya didn't show that. So we have to follow Lord Chaitanya. Yes. Yeah, he never ate things that were not cooked by a Brahmin. He followed the etiquettes. He would go to serve prasad himself. You know, they would have to tell him to sit down. Only if he was invited to someone's house, then he would sit. But if it was all the devotees eating together, he would go and serve. So he followed all the etiquettes. But they're secondary. You know, that's just, you've been doing them since you're a kid, so what's the problem? You learn all those things as a kid. That's why so many of them are discussed in the Brahmacharya ashram, just all those basic things. And then when somebody gets married, then it discusses, you know, so many other things with the house. But the principles are all there, so they would... It was very strict, so the Varna ashram was followed, but it's secondary. So if we put it in its rightful position of being secondary, or support, in a supportive role, but then neglect it, that's not proper. And then, after that, give it a bad name, right? What is it? Give a shastra a bad name and then throw it out, right? Isn't that the saying? Yes.
The analogy of eating is interesting, because if you're sick, maybe you have a sore tooth or sore throat or something, yeah. You're really conscious and more careful about how you chew and how you
eat.
So in the same way, you know,
Yeah.
greater depth around it.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yes, more attention, but you have to understand that you're sick. That's the point. And a sick man can't expect, well, the whole world has to eat boiled sabji. And it has to be mashed up with a spoon, you know, and then taken through a straw, you know. And when they say that, not only are they sick, but then they don't know what they're dealing with. It's unhealthy. Then not only they're unhealthy on all sides. So it's very important. I have no problem. Devotees say, well, we can't, you know, it's so difficult following things and marriages break up and this and that and so many. I have no problem with that. As long as they don't expect that this is going to be established as a standard and everybody's going to become normal for everybody. As soon as that's there, then they've not recognized their position that they're sick. That means they're seriously sick. That means they think they are that body, that culture, everything. As soon as they say, no, I am a Mlecha, Yavana, all this, I can't follow properly, but we're doing the best we can, and you know, now it, you know, after some time, we're figuring it out. We learn by our mistakes. You know, we're honest. We learn. Honesty also means learning by mistakes. You know, honesty doesn't just mean what you can see in others. And then you tell others, why don't you be honest? Honesty means also seeing in ourselves. So, like that. Then we recognize that. Then those who can follow, that's respected. But when the sick people demand that the people who are healthy must follow their diet, then we have a problem. A serious problem. And that from that platform, no social culture can be established. None whatsoever. Because the Western culture doesn't have one. Right? A few pockets of a few people, maybe. But they also follow restriction. Like devotees talk about Amish. Or, you know, like that. You know, their community, this and that. Amish don't allow any music. No dancing, no musical instruments, no ornaments, no smells, no nice anything. And everything is machinery, no electricity. What devotee is going to follow that? Those who sit around and talk like that, half of the stuff they're talking is on email. You know? Or sitting in their air-conditioned office. So, and they're talking about, let's follow the Amish. Right? As their kids are, you know, playing on the video games and listening to all kinds of music and reading karmic books. They only read the Bible. So they talk about, oh, this is there, but they're more, even more restrictive than we are. So it's not practical. It's just how you say, air fill, you know. You know, it makes for interesting conversation. But the reality is if we can't follow the simple rules of the Vedic culture, we're not going to be able to follow the standards of others. We may say, well, West, well, you had the Essenes. But they were very renounced, detached, lived very simply. Right? You take any, you find, go look in the culture anywhere where it was working to some degree. You'll find it was very religiously based. All their activity, you could connect right back to the scriptures, you know, whatever their scripture was. And they were very highly sense controlled. Anything that's been successful anywhere has been due to that. There's no case of no restriction and anything working properly. Right? No restriction and working properly. It means if you check, like right now, in the world, America does not hold the highest standards for education and students being on a high standard of education because they're so liberal. Like that. Maybe at a few schools, but you go to those private schools, then they're much more restrictive. Therefore, they get a higher standard. You know? Like that. All these different things. It's just, you see, when there's restriction and control and regulation, then there's excellence. And when there's not, then there's, you know, what do you call it? Just ordinary. Things are just ordinary. So one has to be able to turn to the Vedic culture for gaining inspiration and insight into what real culture is.
I've heard you speak about That has been ashram for a long, long time now.
Yes.
But,
it is our bad habit.
No, I very much appreciate it, but I'm actually having first-hand realization of it now to a limited degree because I'm working with people doing shudana activity who are way outside of any kind of an ashram.
Yeah.
And I'm also working with the Murti Wallas, who are Dadi Varnashram, actually. They come from a Vaishnava family.
Mm.
And they're generations of generations doing the same thing.
Mm.
And it's really incredible. I mean, everything you speak is actually coming to life for me.
Mm.
Because they're working with the same materials, you know, the same drudgery every day, but their consciousness, their mentality, the way they deal with you is completely different. It's actually to the point of almost being brahminical. You know, they're working on Prabhupada. I want you to sit there and tell them about Prabhupada, why they're working on Prabhupada. You know?
Uh-huh.
Or they want to take books home and read about what they're doing. I mean, it's
so they know the mood and everything.
Yeah,
so they can bring
incredible.
It up. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Completely different.
Main
and they're gentle. You know, they're sensitive to, you know, in talking to. Completely different.
Yeah, very
it's
different.
It's really enlivening, actually.
Yeah.
To see that it can work still.
Oh, that's the thing. Is it's Prabhupada said, dead or alive, it's worth, you know, an elephant, dead or alive, it's worth a lakh of rupees. So even the Vedic culture dead is still worth more than anything else. You know, I mean, it's because the point is in what I was making before. In the West, when you do see any part of where the culture did have some sobriety and steadiness and consistency and all the qualities that we talk about that we want. But in a different paradigm, but you see that it was actually the same principle. It was all based on religion, and they were following strictures of that religion. Therefore, they came up with that. They came like, but because they're starting from a different level of realization in the scriptures, therefore the culture comes out differently. So when that becomes degraded, it becomes disconnected with the Shastra, it becomes very wild. But in India, because there's been so much, the Shastras are so spoken about, and they get into everything. Therefore, then, so much is there that they can fall back on. And the tendency is then they, you know, instead of giving up the rule, they're too attached to them, or, you know, whatever, they get into Niyamagraha. But it's still in relationship to the Vedic culture. So they're it is a lot of difference. Because it's basically just a little bit in the level of just their understanding, the consciousness. It means they'll be a little bit more attached. They lament a little bit more. You know.
A very strong sense of respect, and they understand the position of guru. These things mean a lot to them.
Yeah, that's good. Whatever I'm speaking on, I speak very strongly because I've seen it in India.
Mm-hmm.
If I hadn't seen it, I shouldn't speak so strongly. But I feel I can speak that strong because Prabhupada's, you know, grown up and it's seen and explained it. So devotees will say, okay, he can say that because it was 100 years ago. He's out of touch with the times. Some people do say this. And unfortunately, some of these people have these funny strings around their neck that go from the left shoulder to the right, and they claim to have taken initiation from the founder Acharya of ISKCON and all these kind of things. But I've seen it today going on. You know, in the modern time today. And I've just heard of other devotees even just seeing it a few weeks ago. You know? The devotees who went to install the deities in Bangladesh. The hospitality, the dealings, and all the different things that we talk about, they said they saw there. And even sometimes stronger degree than you see in India. Because there, they feel a bit oppressed. So they naturally identify and follow more strongly their own culture to create an identity. While India is like giving up their identity to follow the West. But it's going on. But unfortunately, many, because they haven't seen it, then it doesn't exist. Right? Isn't that how modern science works? What you can see with your senses, that you believe. That's fact. So that's called anamoy. So even the biggest, you know, PhD scientist, you know, world renowned, is still on the platform of functioning in anamoy, what a small baby is on. They haven't even come to the platform of pranamoy. So one has to be very, very. The whole point of the Vedic culture, why it goes, because it makes one observant. Right? Makes one observant. therefore everything is connected back. You know? Everything is connected back. Thank you for the nice explanation. What time is it now? Okay, so we'll end here. So now, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.